Why I'm no longer vegan. You've heard the statement a thousand times on podcasts, YouTube videos, radio shows, social media posts. In 2020, people are dropping veganism left, right, and center like a ton of bricks. Or so it seems. Are they, or is this just a very vocal minority that we shouldn't be listening to? Now, I want to examine the evidence and I want to look at this objectively because there is a lot of emotion, a lot of heart behind the concept of veganism. It is built around non-violence. It's built around non-suffering for animals, for other humans, for the planet. But is it truly something that is sustainable? Is it truly something that can maintain long-term health, long-term happiness, and long-term prosperity? Or is it just a beautiful ideology that unfortunately does not live up to the biochemical needs of a human body? I thought the perfect person to talk to would be Dr. Leo Venus, a medical doctor and scientist, and someone that has dedicated so many years of his life studying and being immersed in the evidence surrounding plant-based diets from a non-objective and non-biased viewpoint. We're going to dive straight into the science. We're going to look at the most cutting-edge clinical evidence surrounding a plant-based diet and determine whether this is something that can be maintained long-term or whether this is just something that should be left in 2020 with pretty much everything else. So let's get to it. Dr. Leo Venus, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm looking forward to going through this podcast. I think it's a great topic, and I think a lot of people will enjoy it for sure. So thanks so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. And it's an important topic, I think, because as I said, there are a lot of emotions attached to the word veganism, right? It's a very heavy ideology in the sense that most people who come into this for ethical reasons. We come into this because we believe in a fairer, more just world where other beings don't have to die for us to live, a world where we can protect our planet, where we can reduce water, land use, where we can reduce our carbon emissions. All these things are proven. Mm-hmm. I think what people are maybe having more concerns about is this going to be something that can make you healthy and something that can maintain your health long-term? Now, there are a million and one different directions that we can go in with this, right? So I think the best place to start would be the current science that's available on a plant-based diet and what it says about how to make a plant-based diet work, not just for a temporary period, not just because you want to lose weight for a holiday, but because it is something you are so passionate about and you want to make this work for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place to start. And I think the key behind this question is really on how people find, you know, quote unquote truths in their lives, or how people build their opinions, how people try to inform themselves. Because, you know, the word science, right, that word means so many different things to so many people. If I say, well, you got to look at the science, somebody might just Google, you know, science behind veganism and find an article and think that's science. Or some people might think that it's just listening to an interview on a TED talk by a scientist. That's science, right? But I think really, whenever it comes to building your opinions on these really complex, these huge topics that are very, very intertwined, very complicated, there's so many different factors that have a role to play. Really, what you want to do for a realistic picture is to take the big perspective, right? To take a step back and see the entire picture. It's a great that you start with this, because I think this is the most important thing. I always talk about this in my videos, or whenever I do speeches and stuff like that, is the hierarchy of evidence, right? It's probably the most important thing that I have ever learned throughout medical school. And it's basically what the entire medical industry bases their advice on towards patients, because, you know, as a doctor, you have a big responsibility. You can't just tell a patient, I have a gut feeling that if you drink this juice 3 times a day, all your problems are going to be solved. There has to be good evidence backing whatever you say. So the hierarchy of evidence is basically a system to stratify those different types of evidence and then to organize them into how reliable they are. In other words, how much trust, how much confidence can you have in those different types of evidence? So at the very, very bottom, we have things such as expert opinion, which is unfortunately something that people tend to put a lot of weight on, right? So things like doctor interviews or, documents or reports that a single doctor has written, But even more so on social media, you see pseudo experts, people who, you know, pose as experts, but aren't actually really qualified experts. And then people are trusting them. But even if you are a true expert, even if you are qualified, that is one of the lowest grades of evidence, the lower tiers, right? The lowest confidence that you can have. And then as you go up the hierarchy, you have actual, like, you know, crossover studies, population studies, you have cohort studies, you have prospective cohort studies where you take a huge number of people, you follow them over time so you can erase a lot of the biases that come from looking back on a piece of data. And then you have things like randomized controlled trials, which are the gold standard for things like drugs and medications that are used in the industry. This is where you basically control the entire environment and then you take the thing that you're testing, right, against a placebo or the previous best practice medicine. And then you're comparing the outcomes to see if there truly is any difference. And then at the even higher up, you have meta-analyses, systematic reviews, which is basically compilations of huge amounts of studies that are looking at the same outcomes. And then above that, again, you have basically the guidelines of the biggest, most trusted organizations in the world. And these are, you know, these are the reason these are the biggest source of evidence is because these conglomerations of evidence, they're usually done over a year with multiple experts. And I always take the example of the report from the International Agency for Research on Cancer with the WHO when they went and said the processed meats are a class one carcinogen. They definitely seem to cause cancer, colorectal cancer in humans, right? And that was based on almost 1,000 studies based on the work that was done over a long period of time by, I think it was 22 of the leading experts in that field that put so much work into putting this report together. And then you'll have someone on the internet saying, oh, well, I saw this this doctor guy on an interview saying that it's not a big deal. You know, so it's like you're comparing two completely different qualities, right, of evidence. Like one is like way down here and the other one is like at the very top. So basically, I think this is one of the most important things that people need to learn is how to basically organize their ideas, their beliefs, and then just be aware of those beliefs. Be aware, like, why do I believe this? Is it because I've just heard it from people around me? Is it because I've read a study? Is it because I've read a meta-analysis? Is it because I've seen reports from the biggest, most trusted organizations? Or, you know, what is it? And based on the source of your belief, then you can kind of decide how much confidence you should have in it, right? But if it's something you believe just because you've heard it around, then you should have a very low amount of confidence and be very open towards other ideas. On the other hand, if you've heard from the WHO that smoking causes lung cancer, and then some, you know, chain smoker on the street comes up and says, I believe, like, I've seen some new evidence that it's not true, then of course you should believe the most trusted source of evidence. So I really think this is the most important. And when it comes to veganism, the short version of the answer is yes. If you look at the biggest organizations that have to do with nutrition, have to do with diet and human health, all have official, you know, positions where they say that vegetarian and vegan specifically are diets are adequate for health, whether you're talking about adolescents, breastfeeding, elderly athletes, whatever it is. You know, I think the British Nutrition Foundation, you know, where you're from, we got the Dietitians of Canada, we got the Academy of Dietetics here in Norway. It's called the Helsedirektoratet. It's basically the Directory of Health. They have the same position. So the vast majority of the biggest organizations have the same position. The vast majority of the evidence has the same position. So the only logical scientific position to have is that, yes, absolutely, it can be a sustainable lifestyle for most people. But that doesn't mean that there can't be hiccups and there aren't things that we need to look at and be careful with.
Of course. And here is the key, right? Because it's the exact same thing as saying an omnivorous diet can be adequate for everyone, which it can. And but by saying that, we know inherently that an omnivorous diet could mean steak and chips 3 times a day, or it could mean a balanced diet which features lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and the occasional parts of animal products. Now, we know what is going to be healthier. However, there doesn't seem to be the same logic applied to a vegan diet. It seems that people look at it and say, oh, well, a vegan diet is this one iteration of a vegan diet, when really there are so many ways we can look at it and so many ways it can be planned. And there, of course, will be people that are not healthy when they eat a plant-based diet. But then there are many people who are not healthy when they eat an omnivorous diet too. That doesn't mean that the omnivorous diet is to blame. That is just, okay, are they getting all of the nutrients they need? Are they getting all of the fruits and vegetables and phytonutrients, antioxidants? What are their lifestyle factors like? You know, let's use that, that smoker as an example. Are they smoking 30 cigarettes a day while eating the world's best diet? You know, you are still going to run into health concerns. So it's such a broad brush that we're looking at a plant-based diet with, and I don't want people to think it is just this one thing, because there are a million and one ways that you can do it.
A million and two ways, actually.
There you go. No,
exactly. It's amazing. I love how you put that in, because that's the other thing you notice, right? It's the lifestyle. You know, lifestyle medicine is quite a broad, it's a multifactorial thing. People tend to forget that. People tend to just believe that diet is the only thing. If you're eating healthy, you'll be healthy, right? I've met people who think it's all about sports. If you're exercising, you'll be healthy. But the truth is, there are many factors. There's nutrition, there is training, there is sleep, there's stress management, there's your mental health, your social well-being, being outdoors enough. You know, all of these factors play a role. So when you see someone say, okay, this person got sick, it's because they're vegan, it's like, hello, there's so many other things that could be going wrong. And to assume it's such an illogical step. But again, you know, human beings are emotional animals. So if you have this one glaring thing that is like the thing that people are focusing on, which is veganism, then people tend to say, oh, it's the vegan diet, doesn't work. Yep. Whereas the vast majority of health issues that people have might not even be related to diet at all. It could be they're not sleeping well, or they're stressed too much, or, you know, they're not exercising enough, or their mental well-being, their psychology. They have belief systems that are bringing them down, not just on the psychological level, but on the biological level. Mm-hmm. And so there's so many things that play a role. It's such a multifactorial, complex field that to assume that everything has to do with diet is just totally irrational. That's kind of why I find it's almost like a piece of comedy now. Every time I see, like, oh, this person dies during this extreme sport, and it's like, vegan dies, and it's like, oh no, veganism. Or you know, like the classical one here a couple of years ago that everybody was talking about was a baby who died to a vegan parents, and it's like, well, you know, they were feeding it nothing but orange juice since birth, so actually it died because it had extremely ignorant parents, not because they were vegan, right? So it's all of these like associating completely unrelated things, and then having that emotional response, as you say, where people are just like, no, veganism, danger, danger. So it's definitely we have a lot of work to do, Josh, for sure.
We sure do. And I think emotion is key, right? Because that works both ways. There's the emotion that fights against veganism. Then there's also the emotion for veganism. And people can get really caught up in that too, and look at veganism as this holy grail that's going to solve all of the world's problems. Well, it's not that, you know, it's just a very small facet of what is going to make a difference. It's a beautiful ideology, but it is ultimately an ideology. It's a story that we've created and said that this is something that we need to do in order to see benefits for ourselves, for the planet, for the animals, whatever. What I think we need to move away from is less actually getting attached to veganism as a concept and saying, well, what is the kindest thing I can do, both for the planet and for the animals, and also for my health? But veganism isn't going to be this one size fits all thing that is going to solve it all. You know, I still need to, if I am going to eat a plant-based diet for the sake of other beings and for the planet, for the other people on it, I will do that, but I will also pay attention to my health as a completely separate topic. I'm going to make sure I'm eating, you know, essential fats. I'm going to eat fruits and vegetables. I'm going to eat a balanced diet with enough protein, enough calories. And then also, let's take the diet away and let's look at all the other factors that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You know? Let's look at exercise. Let's look at our social, let's look at my social circle. Let's look at my mental health. I've met so many people that on paper, they have the world's most perfect diet, but they're not healthy because there is so much other things going on there. You know, they're spending their life actually analyzing everything to the nth degree, making sure that they get the perfect amount of phytonutrient X in 11 a.m. because Mercury is in retrograde. However, what they're not doing is they're not going out and seeing humans, and they're not connecting on a social level, and they're not living with purpose. And all of these things make up this great big amalgamation that we call health. So it can't just be attached to veganism.
Absolutely. I think that's a beautiful way to put it. And I just want to clarify as well, I'm not saying that, human emotion is a bad thing, right? Emotions are an amazing thing. It's part of what makes life beautiful and what makes life exciting. But yeah, it's really being aware of the emotional aspect of the human being. The human animal is an emotional animal, and being aware of that can be extremely helpful in order to make the right decisions and not allow these emotions to completely short circuit the whole process, so that you end up believing in something so strongly that it blinds you from other things. And I think, as you say, you know, the ideology is a beautiful ideology. It's something I'm super passionate about. But you know, it's one of the things I see is when people identify themselves so strongly to any one thing, it almost becomes like this curtain around them, where it's like anything else becomes bad. It's like, this is, we are team vegan, everyone else is against us. And you have this me versus them approach, this exclusivity approach, which is the opposite of what we want. We want the inclusivity. We want to be open arms. We want to be welcoming. We want everybody to, you know, be attracted to this movement, not this whole like, us versus them. We want the we frame. It's, we are doing this together. We are encouraging people. We are supporting people on their journey, rather than pointing fingers and saying shame, 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 because it's one thing about human psychology that you can see throughout the ages, that shaming people is not a long-term, not a successful long-term strategy for positive change. So that would be something that I would really challenge people on, and ask people to be a little bit aware of is do they really think that people are bad, you know, in any way for not being vegan, or as you say, do they really think that veganism is the be all end all of goodness? Like, you know, there's so many other things that we could be doing. And, you know, as you say, just being vegan in and of itself is not going to save the world. We need a lot of other things. We need, you know, consumerism, like the clothing industry is a huge polluter, even if it is completely vegan clothes. But if you're buying a ton of stuff and you're just the polyesters that are being used for, you know, all of these clothes, fast fashion, right? Electricity, internet, we're all using a ton of internet. That also uses a crazy amount of energy. So there's a lot of things that kind of people could also think about again. But I think just this, the judgmental mindset, I think, is the thing that we need to avoid, because it's, you know, everybody has the reasons for being the way they are and for believing the things that they believe in. It's just that we don't have the full picture. We don't see, you know, when I'm looking at you and talking to you and seeing this really insightful, reflected young man who's done so much great for the world, I'm seeing you through a tiny, tiny window of my perspective. But there's millions and millions and millions of influences that have built you up into the man who you are today that I have no idea about. So for me to stand here and try to make a judgment on whether or not it's good or bad that you are the way you are, it's just completely irrational, completely... it's a very, very illogical thing to do, because it's like being a judge on a singing contest and never have heard a song before, or have heard one note of one song in one part of the world, of one culture, and then thinking that you're going to become the best judge in the world in like the field of music. Like we have such tiny, tiny insights. And I think that's really important to remember.
It's a really beautiful perspective, and that is so powerful. And actually, it's probably removing that place of judgment altogether, isn't it? Because the vast majority of people you meet are doing their best. The vast majority of people you meet are going to be trying their best to make positive decisions that they believe are going to help people around them, the people that they love, the people that they don't know, and the world in general. And for so many people, that looks different. We are only here talking about a plant-based diet because we have been fortunate enough to be exposed to science and influence and intelligent conversations and all of these things that led us to come to the knowing and the understanding that this is right now, based on the available evidence, the best thing that we can do from a dietary perspective in order to create a brighter future. However, there are millions, if not billions, of people around the world that haven't had that same exposure to those media sources, to that news, to that information, to that science. That does not make them bad people whatsoever. That just means they have not had this exact same exposure. However, if we were to talk to them, then they could most likely show me something that I have no idea about right now that I could be doing that would reduce ocean pollution, for example. Mm-hmm. But because they've been exposed to that and they've studied it, and that's part of their in integration into this crazy thing we call life, right? And we have so many things. It's not a case of us versus them. It's not a case of vegans versus non-vegans, science versus non-science. This is all together learning and growing from each other, and that's the only way we're going to move forward, be it veganism, be it whatever. Let's keep it on veganism though, because we could go in a million different directions, and I often do. So I want to go through a few of the common concerns that people may have about diet and look at them under the microscope of science. One that's come up quite recently is omega-3 and brain function. And that is something that is, I think, quite rightly, there should be a microscope shone on it, because omega-3 is a really essential nutrient. Our brain is 60% fat, and omega-3 forms the neurological structure of our brain. It's required for memory, learning ability, brain growth in children. It's required to prevent brain aging and even brain shrinking as we age. So it is vitally important. So I'm so happy people are talking about it. How do I get omega-3 on a plant-based diet, and can I get enough?
This is a great question. You're asking all the good questions today. That's good. So omega-3s is, like you said, it's a great, great concept. It's a great subject. I think it's one of those areas where the science isn't completely conclusive. We don't really know exactly what is the right amount for every single person. And most likely it varies again from person to person, right? But in terms of sources, you can definitely get them in terms of nuts, seeds, quite a few vegetables have quite a lot of omega-3s. So there's quite a few ways of doing it. But the thing is to be aware of is that there's different types of omega-3s. So you have ALA, or alpha-linolenic acid, which is the type of omega-3 that you find a lot in terrestrial plants, right? And then you have the longer chain omega-3s, which are EPA, or eicosapentaenoic acid, and DHA, or docosahexaenoic acid. And those are the ones that you find mostly in the ocean. Now, a lot of people say, well, fish make them, and that's why we need fish. Well, it turns out fish can't make these omega-3s either, just like us, and they actually get it from phytoplankton, they get it from microalgae, and that's how they increase it. But then again, it's one of these things, again, trying to get the whole perspective, right? Back in, throughout evolution, human beings have always lived close to bodies of water, right? We've always been close to rivers, close to oceans, and we've all eaten quite a bit of fish. Not a huge amount, perhaps, especially not a huge amount of meat, but we've always had a little bit of animal products, which perhaps was the main source of the longer chain omega-3 fatty acids throughout most of our evolution. And I think this is a point I would like to just bring in, because a lot of times you hear this kind of almost like argument that it's like, well, veganism wouldn't have been possible throughout evolution. And yeah, perhaps that's true. Actually, most likely that's true, because vitamin B12, for example, is very unlikely that you'd ever be able to get enough of that unless you were eating small amounts of animal products. So true, we weren't vegan throughout evolution. Does that mean that we shouldn't be vegan now? Again, these are two unrelated questions, right? So just because we couldn't have been vegan before doesn't mean we can't be vegan now. So now we have vitamin B12 supplements, and now we have planes. We couldn't drive planes throughout our evolution, right? So this is it's completely unrelated subjects, but I don't want to digress too much. Going back to omega-3s, there are definitely algae-based omega-3 fatty acids. There's definitely a lot of different areas that have been studied with omega-3s. There are studies looking at heart health, whether or not supplementing omega-3s is going to improve heart health. There's studies on brain health, as you mentioned, and there's definitely enough evidence to say that they play an important role. It's essential nutrient, is very, very important for us. But I wouldn't say there is conclusive evidence that supplementing is necessary for either heart health or brain health. I think for brain health, it's more possible that it could be more helpful. But there, you know, the question most people ask is it enough to just have the short chain omega-3 fatty acid? Is it enough to just have the ALA and then have that conversion to EPA and DHA happen naturally? And that's where the evidence isn't completely conclusive. But, you know, what are the risks associated with taking a a non-polluted algae-based omega-3 fatty acid supplement, well, there's no evidence to show that there is high risks of that. I mean, there was a bit of people talking about risk of prostate cancers with supplements, but that was based on very, you know, very low grade evidence. And so that's definitely not something that I would go around, worrying about. And if you take, again, a whole look at the entire perspective, again, which I always say is so important, is that most of the evidence suggests that it's not a risk, even if a few studies say, oh, perhaps there is an association, right? So the short answer would be absolutely super important nutrient. I would definitely recommend people eat things like ground flax seeds, ground chia seeds, lots of vegetables that have omega-3s. But, you know, also if you're, you know, if you are vegan, perhaps if you want to be on the safe side, why not supplement with an algae-based long-chain omega-3 such as EPA and DHA, right? So I think that's kind of still on the individual level, but especially if you're not very good at consistently getting a ton of those flax seeds and chia seeds in so that you have enough of those precursors to convert in your body, then I would definitely say make sure to take those omega-3s, because most likely it's going to be more helpful than harmful.
Yeah, and let's also compare the risks. You know, we talk about any potential risks that come with a DHA supplement from algae. Well, actually, they're much, much lower than risks that could potentially come from fish consumption in the modern day world. Again, I'm not going to promote an ideology where I say that fish is unhealthy. For most of our evolution, it's been a really important food. However, now with the way that the oceans are, how polluted a lot of our water sources are, the way that fish are farmed, the way that they are intensively reared with fake diets, given food colorings, feeding on microplastics, PCBs, dioxins. Well, actually, the majority of fish that we can consume and are consuming in the modern day world is not, is probably far less healthy than consuming an algae supplement, where the algae is grown in controlled environments, mineral water, so there's no pollutants, no contaminants, and you're going straight to the source. So it just seems that, again, this isn't something we have done for our evolution, but it seems like if you are going to eat those long chain omega-3 fatty acids, this seems that now, based on the current evidence, that going straight to the source is a much more sensible approach for those that do want to make sure they're getting that DHA and EPA in. And you're right, the science is still unknown, but isn't that always the case with science? You know, we don't want to take a viewpoint where we think that we know everything and that's like box ticked, because if that had been the case, then we'd all be sitting around a campfire still, you know, just like we would never have gone anywhere. So let's always keep that open mindset where we can say that, you know, we are available and willing to listen to new evidence and willing to question our own viewpoints too.
Yeah, absolutely, it's so important, and I love this topic. So it's like, just if you look at the pattern is, you know, the more ignorant people are, the more they think they know everything, right? I think it was Garth Davis who had a quote once on his Instagram that obviously got a lot of people angry, but it's you know, he likes to put out some provocative stuff, but he said something like, you know, the most stupid among us are the most confident among us, unfortunately. And then, you know, that got the comments going pretty quick, but it's so true. You know, the more you learn about something, the more you see the intricacies and the complexities that are within certain subjects, the more you understand there's so much we don't understand. The more you see, you know, for my experience, going through medical school, going through my medical degree, seeing so much of how the industry works and finding out how much of the diseases we deal with, we call idiopathic, meaning we don't know what causes it, how many of the actual treatments that we use, we don't understand how they work. We just see, okay, when a patient gets this, they feel better, so we're going to continue doing this. And that's, you know, it's kind of eye-opening to see how much of this entire thing is still unknown. And I think, again, the identity mindset I touched on earlier is a bit important here as well, because, you know, people tend to, you know, we're lazy animals. We like to just say, okay, this is me. I'm this type of person. You're this type of person. I'm here. But it can be, again, it can be so easy to just put yourself in this box where this is your reality, and then you close yourself off to all of these other possibilities. Same for, you know, diet. It's like, okay, I'm a natural person, so I'm only going to do things that are natural, right? I'm only going to eat the way we ate naturally. I'm only going to live the way we did naturally. But then, you know, you might use a computer, which is not natural at all, right? Or you might be a person who identifies as someone who doesn't like, you know, climbing mountains or whatever it is, right? But when you identify yourself as a certain something, that puts you in a box. And there's just so many, you know, that's a kind of in psychology, we have these concepts called cognitive distortions, which are subconscious belief systems that don't align with reality. And one of the ones you see most commonly is the black and white cognitive distortion, this all or nothing mindset, right? Where it's like, well, either things are this way or it's this way. But the reality, again, of the world we live in is there are so many exceptions to almost every single rule out there. There are so many different ways of doing the same thing that having this approach will more often than not put you in the position where you're misaligned with reality. And you know, of course, if you're misaligned with reality, you're in conflict. Your belief system believes one thing and reality is another thing. And you know, you can't change reality, that's fixed. But your belief system, that's what we need to start changing so that we can be aligned with the reality that we live in. And I think, again, having too much of a focus of like, oh, well, veganism wasn't natural, or like, oh, I'm a natural person. But, you know, you want to use a computer, you want to use medicine. I mean, we're starting to cure genetic diseases, which require technology, requires this, you know, this innovation, this medical innovation, where we're actually changing people's genes before they're even born to avoid them having these crippling and devastating diseases their entire lives. Sometimes they don't even live, you know, people can have genetic diseases that are horrendous. And we're starting to get to the point where we can actually play with people's genes to avoid a huge amount of suffering. And then you have someone be like, oh, well, that's not natural, right? So, of course, I think as a general rule, being aligned with what we would naturally be doing as a species for the vast majority of our evolution is great. That is probably going to be the healthiest approach in most cases. But then there's a ton of unnatural things that we do in life, which are great, which saves a lot of people from a lot of suffering, saves a lot of people from a lot of diseases, which make life more exciting. I mean, we couldn't be doing this podcast if we weren't using some of our unnatural innovations, right? So I think just being a little bit open to allowing these mixed complexities into your life and not allowing yourself to fall too quickly into this identity mindset where everybody gets put in a box and then that's it, right? I don't know if that makes sense. It's kind of like a little bit of a conceptual talk here, but...
Well, no, it makes complete sense. And what a beautiful adventure to go into the world, reality as we see it, and know that you do not know a thing. Know that because if you have that mindset, everything's a mystery. Every conversation is a potential to learn. Every thing that you encounter is something new and something magical and something mystical, and why not approach life like that? That's going to be a lot more fun. People are going to like you a lot more because you're going to listen and you're going to want to hear what they have to say rather than saying, no, I believe this and I'm not going to listen. Of course, you can bring your opinions forward, but the more we know, the more we realize we don't know. And then when you realize you don't know anything, then life becomes this one big mystery and adventure of constantly finding out, constantly questioning, and also not taking it too seriously. Because if you're coming into this with a fixed mindset, this is my belief and no one's going to challenge it, then suddenly there's resistance there, and that's not a very nice place to be. If I can meet you and be open to learning and listening to what you have to say, then suddenly I'm going to get something out of this conversation, and actually it's going to enrich my life in some way. If I went into this with a closed mindset saying I know this and only this, and if you don't believe me then like we can't be friends, then I've potentially ruined a beautiful relationship here.
Exactly. And I think that's something that comes along, especially with veganism, is where people are, you know, social aspect of veganism is the most difficult aspect for most people. Yeah. And I think this the mindset of like, when I hang out with non-vegans, I have to be constantly on the defense. I have to, you know, prove my opinions. I have to, whenever they challenge me, I have to be on point. I have to give the right answers. And it's like, it's completely, again, if you're learning about human psychology, if you learn about the way the social animal that is the human being behaves and takes in opinions and takes in information and how they form their opinions, how they form their beliefs and how they behave accordingly, I think you'll understand very quickly that spewing facts and being on the defensive and trying to prove yourself right is going to be far from the most effective way of influencing your peers. Rather, having, as you said, a lighthearted nature, being even able to joke about yourself and not taking yourself so seriously and being able to self-deprecate and just have fun and be relaxed and be comfortable and have people feel those good vibes. Again, we're emotional animals. If you're feeling a good vibe with someone, you're way going to be way more open and way more likely to associate that vegan philosophy that that person is having with those good feelings that you have when you're with that vegan person. If you're with a vegan person, every time you talk to them, it's an argument, it's a fight, it's a this uncomfortable feeling, and you feel like there's some sort of a personal attack and it's just uncomfortable, you get this weird vibe, that's going to be associated with veganism. People are going to be like, yeah, veganism is this weird thing. So again, it's really, really important to be aware of this and try to develop yourself into someone who is able to be confident in the things that you do and the things that you believe, but also be totally comfortable being with people who believe different things and be able to have a good time. And, you know, I think right now I'm, you know, I've been traveling for a few weeks now with a group of Norwegian colleagues who are not vegan at all. And it's been fun. I mean, they are very comfortable talking about veganism. A lot of people tell me, well, people never want to talk about veganism because they're not comfortable. Well, that's because they're not getting that vibe. Right. If they feel like it's a non-judgmental, it's a friendly, it's a lighthearted vibe, they'll be comfortable. I mean, they ask me about vegan stuff all the time, and we have fun and we talk about whatever we feel like, and there's no judgment, there's no defensiveness. It's just a comfortable chat, and you know, that's definitely the way to go over going over and, you know, trying to like point fingers again and shame people into doing what they're doing. But then again, reality is a complex thing. I'm sure a little bit of that shaming stuff or a little bit of that harsher activism is good in certain settings, especially things like in social media, where it's not a one-to-one conversation. There's just so many different dynamics. But when you're talking to people in person, in real life, that's a very, very important thing to keep in mind is what is the vibe, right? What are people feeling when they're having a conversation with you? Because that's that's what's going to really move them towards anything, is how they feel, not if what you're saying is factually correct or not.
Million and 1%. So let's take it back then to a couple more reasons that people might be struggling, because I want people to be able to come into this podcast and get and erase any doubts or anything that even, you know, they may be struggling with and may not know how to get X nutrient, or they may feel they're lacking in this. They may have a test. One thing I see that has come up, and it's come up in a couple of friends too, is iron, where iron can be sourced, if it can be sourced, and the difference between heme and non-heme iron. Is that something you'd be comfortable talking about for a little bit, and we can...
Absolutely. I mean, if we want to give a little like quick introduction or a whole picture of the things that people worry about, I think iron is definitely up there. Yep. Iron, luckily, is one of the easiest ones to fix because the plant kingdom is rich with iron. There's so much iron in the plant kingdom. So if you know where to look and if you plan your diet a little bit, it's very easy to get enough iron. You mentioned non-heme versus heme. So heme is mostly in animal products, while non-heme is found in plant products, right? The main difference is we have these iron transporters in our bodies that there's different ones. So for the heme iron, the thing is you basically absorb all of it. All the heme iron you eat, you absorb. And this is even if you have too much iron. This is the other side of the spectrum that people don't always think about, is that we have a lot of iron overload in society today where people have too much iron. And this is also not great for us. It's associated with a lot of chronic conditions and a lot of stuff that you don't want to get, like heart disease and different types of cancer, etc. So diabetes. So you definitely don't want to have too much iron either. But you'll be surprised when you start looking into really high sources of iron. You'll start finding, you know, things like, you know, dried apricots or molasses or, you know, things that you're like, what? This has iron. So there's definitely a lot of foods that have a lot of iron. And if you combine that with a vitamin C, that has to do with the co-transport through the non-heme iron transport through the body. It's better absorbed if you have it combined with vitamin C. But the nice thing, the beautiful thing about non-heme iron is if you have enough iron in your body, you will absorb less of it. So there isn't that same risk of getting too much iron. And at the same time, if you're low in iron, your body will increase the uptake. So you'll actually absorb more non-heme iron to the point where it actually isn't too far away from being at the same rate of the heme iron. So it's a much more variable spectrum of how much are you absorbing. But yeah, absolutely, iron, I would look into what are the, you know, the top sources. And especially if you're a menstruating girl, you need to be a little bit more aware of this because you're losing iron through your periods.
Yep.
But for anyone who is worried about iron, just take a look. There's a lot of really good stuff. And obviously, it's not about knowing where to get it. It's about actually getting it and putting it in your mouth, right? So I would have to, you have to get a routine where every single day you're consistently eating these really high sources of iron. Another one that people worry about is zinc. Again, tons of sources of zinc in the plant kingdom. But if you're not aware of it, if you're not thinking about it, you might go, you know, you might be low. This one is the opposite. Guys are a little bit more at risk of getting zinc deficiencies than girls. And it's actually the more you ejaculate, the more likely you, the more zinc you're going to need as well. So for the horny vegan rabbits out there, make sure to get enough zinc. And
it's,
then
if you want numbers, it's roughly 5 to 10 milligrams of zinc. But
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, it's one to keep in mind for sure, especially now during Corona times where everybody's indoors in lockdown.
Yep.
And then one that a lot of people worry about is iodine as well.
Mm.
Now, iodine is an interesting one. It's one of the, you know, historically it was the biggest deficiency. You know, we had a huge societal problems with people with goiters, with people, you know, the development of children was being affected because they didn't have enough iron. You know, there's a lot of health issues in the past that were to do with iron, not iron, sorry, I think I'm mixing the two, iodine. So due to iodine deficiency, one of the biggest things that fixed that was actually the fortification of flour. So we started fortifying flour with iodine. And, you know, nowadays, anyone who eats bread, especially, you know, the processed junk that isn't great for us, right? White bread that is enriched, quote unquote, where they take out, you know, tons of nutrients and then they add 8 back and they're like, oh, now it's enriched. So it's definitely not good for you. But one of the things that they do add is iodine. And that was one of the big things that fixed our issues from a society point of view, where people weren't getting huge rates of iodine deficiency anymore. But of course, white bread is not great for us, right? The whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead. So I wouldn't say that's a good source.
Is that a peer-reviued statement, Dr. Leo Venus?
Yes, that is a peer-reviewed statement. Well, I mean, it's amazing, Josh. When you look at the nutrition from whole grain sources or whole grain foods, and then you compare them to their refined alternative, whether you're looking at, you know, wheat versus, or you know, whole wheat versus refined wheat, or if you're looking at barley or rice or whatever it is, and you look at the actual nutritional content of the whole grain versus the refined grain, it's amazing. It's scary, really. You look at, you know, it will be like protein, you lose like 50%, and then like iron, you lose like 70%, calcium like 80%. Like these are just, you know, example numbers. They're not like the actual accurate numbers, but it's around those types of numbers you see. It's like between, you know, 50 and 95% of these nutrients are just falling off. And it just, when you think about that, it's like, wow, I'm like losing so much nutrition from choosing this refined product versus the whole grain product. So of course, I would say, you know, when it comes to being as healthy as possible in terms of your nutrition, optimizing your diet, I would say it wouldn't be the smartest to just go and eat a ton of white loaf bread just because it's enriched with iodine. But the other thing that people have used a lot historically has been iodized salt. That's been very, very helpful. Otherwise, it's seafood again. That's the only place where the source of iodine is reliable, because there's iodine in the soil. You can get it from beans, nuts, legumes, potatoes. You can get it from cranberries. You can get it from a lot of different things, but it's very dependent on the quality and the quantity of iodine that is in the soil where those specific foods are grown. So it's very unreliable. So if you want a reliable source, you got to look towards the sea. You got some seaweeds like nori. There's kelp is used for some supplements. I wouldn't recommend eating kelp directly, because I can actually have too much iodine, so you can have iodine toxicity. There's things like I think Hijiki is one where you have a higher risk of arsenic poisoning. But you know, things like nori are pretty safe sources of iodine. There's some other seaweeds as well. Can't think of them now out of the top of my head. And then obviously there's always the option to supplement as well. There's quite a few safe iodine supplements out there. The only thing I would say again is you have to be careful with supplements. It's not about the more the better. Sometimes too little is bad, but too much is bad as well. And iodine has a known toxicity to it. So depending on your age and what stage of life you're on, you want to be getting the right amount. So for pregnant and breastfeeding, you want to actually be getting a little bit more. For normal adults, I think it's around 150 micrograms a day. So you want to make sure that if you're going to supplement, you're getting the right dose and you're not taking too much. Apart from that, I would say the ones, obviously B12, I think that one is a no-brainer. Everybody should be taking B12. It's the reason, probably the number one reason that veganism wouldn't have been sustainable in throughout evolution is because you don't get enough B12. So yep. Luckily today we live in a world where it's so easy to supplement B12. So that's definitely a must. And then
a must for everyone, right? Not just for vegans. It's actually I think it's between 20% and 40% of the world have a deficiency or a near deficiency in B12. So if you look at the numbers, there's a lot more people there than there are people eating just a plant-based diet. Unfortunately, absolutely. even the animals that people eat as a source of B12 are now given B12 supplements. Mm-hmm. So it is just something that, much like iodine, we have to look at more at different ways to get it in our diet, because it's not now in the food supply as a reliable source. So, mm-hmm. you know, whether you're vegan or not vegan, this is B12 is not just a vegan issue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's totally correct. I think, again, the way we sanitize and the way we grow our food and the way we feed our animals, everything's become so unnatural that there's a huge change in the kind of biodiversity of the microorganisms that they're surrounded by. So B12 is naturally one of the things that have been extracted from the natural surroundings of our food system. Vegans tend to have a higher risk just because, you know, even whether they're supplement or not, you know, the animals do contain some B12. But absolutely, like you say, it's a huge amount of people who aren't vegan who have B12 issues with B12 as well. And that's why it's recommended to every single person who's over 50. If you're vegan, definitely don't go around saying, oh, you know, I feel good, I don't need B12. It's like, take your B12. There's no ands, ifs, or buts. It's definitely a must. And then, you know, we talked about iron, we talked about zinc, we talked about iodine.
You're answering all my questions for me, by the way, so it's fantastic. Every single one that I had written down.
Yeah, is there any specific ones that we haven't touched on that you're thinking about? I think calcium, some people wondering about. Again, a very easy one to get if you know where to find it. You know, if you look at different sources, I think this is why I say it's very healthy for people to track a couple of days every now and then and just see what kind of numbers are they hitting, right? So we're using something like chronometer or something just to see where they are. And then seeing, okay, if I'm consistently low on, say, selenium, let's look at some foods that have some selenium. Or if I'm consistently low on iron. Oh, are you here? Yeah. So if you're consistently low on iron, just make sure you find some of those foods that are high in iron, right? So you can be a little bit smarter in your approach and plan a little bit more. But again, I think the vast majority of nutrients are, you know, minerals especially come from the soil. That's where the minerals are found. So plants naturally have a lot of different minerals. So you know, the thing about iron and calcium and selenium and, you know, all of these things usually are very, very easy to get if you just take a little bit of time to look and see, okay, which are the best sources, right? So it's not really a problem. I think the four most difficult ones are B12 that we mentioned, vitamin D. It's more of the sunshine vitamin. It's actually more of a hormone than a vitamin. When you're hit by the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, you actually synthesize it from the cholesterol that you have around your body. We actually make all the cholesterol we need. That's another thing that people think, oh, we need to eat cholesterol. And then you make the vitamin D from that. It's actually, like I said, more of a hormone really than a vitamin. So it's kind of a misnomer, but as long as you're getting enough sun, vitamin D is fine. If you're not getting enough sun, vegan or not, take a vitamin D supplement. So we got B12, we've got vitamin D. Iodine, we talked about, is really only reliable from the ocean. So either iodized salt or seaweeds or a supplement. And then the last one I would say is kind of like a little bit difficult to get is the long chain omega-3s. So supplementing that could be something to consider. All the other ones is just a question of looking at what are the sources on a vegan diet and implementing those into your diet, because it's very, very easy to get all of these minerals.
Yeah, and again, I want to circle back onto something you were talking about earlier, and that's the soil that they're grown in, because plants are only as good as the soil that they're grown in. Mm-hmm. So in order to make sure that you are, because it can be a very complex topic to make sure I'm getting enough of every single mineral, vitamin, phytonutrient. Well, mm-hmm. really one of the easiest things we can do is to prioritize eating food that is grown in the right conditions. So grown in healthy soil, locally grown, organic where possible, minimal food mm-hmm. miles, as fresh as possible. And that may mean actually changing your consumer habits a little bit. That may mean looking at where your food is sourced from. Is it grown in ultraviolet light in is it tomatoes grown in the middle of winter that, you know, are bright red but probably have no nutritional value, or is it tomatoes that are grown from your local farmer or even in your mm-hmm. back garden? It's a very different thing, and this is where I think this is kind of like veganism 2.0. you know, you're looking mm-hmm. at not just eating plant foods, but you're looking at eating the best sources that you can, both mm-hmm. for you and for the planet. So again, it does not stop at the V word. You can always do more, both for yourself and for the planet and people as a whole. So that's one thing I just want to throw into the mix, you know, making sure
absolutely
there's good sources of foods too.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff. And yeah, good thing you didn't throw in the V word. Oh no. Protect our ears. The V word. Oh no. No, but that's a great point. And I think, again, it's like we talked about with environmentalism, you know, growing food naturally, growing food locally. There's just so many other things apart from veganism that are helpful. But yeah, 100% agree. You're impressing me like always, Josh. You've you've gotten a good grasp on all of this stuff. So I feel like my work here is easy peasy. I'm just reiterating what you're saying here.
Okay, well, I try my best. I certainly don't touch the level of education that you have on this, which is why I'm really grateful to bring you in to it. There is one thing I want to add into this as well, and this is going to kind of move away from the actual dietary side, but this is belief and true conviction in whatever diet or whatever way of eating, to know that in the vast majority of cases, our body has an inherent ability to adapt and to be healthy. And it is when we start, every time we see an article or a celebrity who's saying, you'd be aware of this on a vegan diet, or this vegan diet didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. There is, on a subconscious level, our brain is saying, oh, maybe this won't work for me. Maybe I'm not doing this right. Maybe I should consider eating some fish or whatever. Every time we do that, we're actually creating resistance and mm-hmm. disease within the body, because we're saying on a cellular level, actually, you know, I'm not sure I do believe this. And if you don't believe this is healthy, then your body will follow. So it's mm-hmm. having that strength and that conviction to know that there are millions of people who are thriving on a plant-based diet. There are millions mm-hmm. of people thriving on an omnivorous diet, whatever your dietary choice is. But knowing that your body is extremely capable of adapting, being healthy, there will be days where you don't get enough calcium, there'll be days where you don't get enough protein, iron, mm-hmm. whether you're vegan or not. But that doesn't mean, you know, you're going to wake up the next morning and be anemic, or you're not going to be able to get out of bed. Mm-hmm. Your body can adapt. So giving that space and that understanding and that permission, keyword mm-hmm. is permission, your body to be healthy, because if you can't give it permission, then no doctor, no medical scientist, no research paper will ever be able to give it that either.
Great topic to touch on. I think this is an area that even today, even though we have so much scientific evidence that is supporting the power of belief and the power of faith, it still gets this kind of woo-woo kind of vibe. I was like, oh, beliefs are like psychology, that's just like it's all in your head type of thing. But there's no doubt from today's scientific evidence, from the medical knowledge that we've gotten through psychiatry, through, you know, behavioral therapies that we've been doing, through randomized controlled trials comparing placebos to medications. It's a huge, huge power that is hidden in the way that you think, in the way that you believe things. And There's a couple of things that I would want to touch on. Number one is exactly what you were saying, right? So just that placebo effect, that just that belief of thinking that you are doing something right, or just knowing that you're doing something good for you, and believing that you're going to be, just that belief system in and of itself is actually going to make you a lot healthier. That doubt, that fear, that resistance that gets built up in people who are always second guessing themselves is not going to do you any good. And a lot of people, they actually think themselves into bad health. This is a concept we've seen again and again in medicine, where people actually believe that they're going to get sick until they get sick. So, and there's no actual other external sources of their illness. So it's definitely not a woo-woo thing. It's actually a very, very grounded, proven concept by now. The other thing I would say is to have your expectations again matching reality. So whenever you hear about a celebrity not doing well on a vegan diet, expect that. Don't be surprised. Oh, here comes another one. This means that I shouldn't be so sure about myself. No, expect. Humans are humans. They behave the way they behave, and celebrities are going to go off the vegan wagon. There's going to be media outlets saying veganism is dangerous, baby dies, or this vegan celebrity falls off the wagon, or vegan propaganda, this and that. There's going to be a lot of media titles. There's going to be a lot of drama. There's going to be a lot of talk and conversation. You need to just focus on the reality that the best sources of evidence, the scientific community, the best organizations are all in agreement that this is totally a sustainable diet if you do it right, as well as having your other lifestyle factors on point. And then expect these other hiccups. And then the other one where I would say expectations are key is, you also mentioned, you might not get 100% every day. Actually, even, the thing about reference ranges, and this is something I see a lot when people take blood tests and say, oh, I'm a little bit under the reference range for iron. I'm sick. No, you're not sick. Reference ranges, the way they make reference ranges for in the medical industry is basically they take 100 healthy people, people who have nothing wrong with them. There are no complaints, no symptoms. And then they will make a reference range where 95% of people are within that range. That means that 2.5% are above, 2.5% are below, and there's nothing wrong with them whatsoever. So having a blood test that comes out a little bit above or a little bit below does not necessarily mean you're sick or you're unhealthy. And the same thing, if you're not eating, sometimes your body will actually, you'll be a human being who does well on 70% of a certain nutrient every single day. You might not even need 100%, right? Some people might need 105% for one day, and one day, getting 30%, one day getting 200% is fine. Our bodies are good at recycling, at storing, at using things in different ways. We live in this analog world where everything is different. We're not this digital computer, like 5.2 grams of this nutrient in every day at hour in this minute. Like, that's not how it works, right? So we need to be aware that life is very fluid, and just have that expectation of how things are, accept reality, and just be grounded in knowing that, again, the hierarchy of evidence, the actual trustworthy stuff is saying one thing. Whatever celebrities say, whatever media says, expect that. Don't be surprised by that. And then also don't allow the fears of, like, oh, like the whole, again, bringing that understanding and that reference ranges and percentages on, like, daily. That does not mean you must get 100%. Does not mean that you must be in. It's one of the things I say as a doctor, say, if you're healthy, stay away from the doctors, because if you go to the doctors enough, if you are afraid enough, if you are nervous enough about your health, and you go in and get yourself checked again and again and again, they will find something that is quote unquote wrong with you. They will find some tests that are outside the norm, which will just take you down that rabbit hole of more tests, more procedures. Some people have even gone through surgeries that are completely unnecessary. There's so much pain and suffering that is caused by unnecessary worrying. So if you're healthy and you have no symptoms, stay away from the doctors. Just do what you know works. Stay healthy, stay happy. And then, doing a general checkup, especially for things like B12 every couple of years, absolutely recommended. But don't, think yourself this is called the medical student syndrome, when people are learning about all these diseases. Oh, do I have this? Do I have that? And then you just worry yourself so much, you go to the doctor so much, they will find something that is quote unquote abnormal. So that's how we are. Human beings have abnormalities. That's just how things are. You're not sick or unhealthy if you have something that is a little bit different than most people.
Yeah, and also, how quick can that become your story? If I go to a doctor who I've been conditioned my whole life to believe is an expert in X, and he's going to make me sick or he's going to make me healthy, and then doctor tells me I have symptom Y, then suddenly I identify with symptom Y. This is me. This is my disease, mm-hmm. and everything I do is reinforcing that belief. And actually, that will just manifest and grow over time anyway. And suddenly now I'm not Josh Bowling. I'm Josh Bowling with this particular disease, and then that becomes my story. And every time I tell someone, I reinforce that. And every time I think of, okay, how am I going to do you know what I'm saying? So it's
exactly it's the diagnosing effect. It's very dangerous as well. Yeah.
So it's just having that broader understanding. And again, this is not to discount the people who are genuinely, you know, suffering from an illness or a disease. Mm-hmm. You know, these things are real. We're not making them all up in our head. But
of course,
there has to be that level of knowing and trusting in your body's biological capability. Look, it's got us this far, right? It's got us through times when supplements weren't available and we couldn't go to the health food store and get cacao and chia seeds and ashwagandha. You know, it's got us all this way, and if we let that inherent wisdom continue, it will get us a lot further too. It's combining that inherent wisdom and that biological knowing with also what we have now, which is a real high mental understanding of these subjects too. If we can blend those together, then there's no stopping us.
Absolutely, I love it. Again, we're bringing it back full circle. We got again the being open to the complexities, not being black or white, having realistic expectations and being open to all the intricacies and the differences. We know there are always exceptions to every rule, and being open to that, you know, as you said, we're not saying all cases are this or all cases are that, but there's a lot of things that you need to be open for. And I think this is a really fascinating stuff to talk about. I'm just a little bit worried. I got a notification that I have 3% left. So if there's anything you want to end on, Josh, I think we need to move there pretty quickly.
No, man, I think we've pretty much covered anything. The last thing I want to know is where can people find you and learn more of your stuff?
Awesome. So YouTube, I've actually been doing daily vlogs. It's been a new journey for me, which has been very fun as well. So that's been going on for almost a month now, actually. So it's been really cool. So YouTube is Dr. Leo Venus. Instagram is the same, Dr. Leo Venus. And I have a website, drleovenus.com. It's the same thing on every single platform. I would say though, if you really want to, you know, get a hold of me, because I have so many DMs on Instagram and YouTube comments, I try to read as many as I can, but the most reliable way to get a hold of me is if you go to my Instagram and you click my email, send me an email. I will definitely see that. Otherwise, I'll try to get back to you as well, but there's no guarantee that I'll see an Instagram message or a comment on YouTube.
Amazing. Leo, truly, truly appreciate your time. It's so refreshing to speak to someone who is so knowledgeable on the mental level, but also so open on the physical level, and knowing that whilst we know so much, we also know so little. And that is such an important takeaway from this podcast, I think. So yeah, truly grateful. And let's save the last part of your battery in case you need an emergency call today.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great talk, and keep up the amazing work you're doing, Josh. I think a lot of people really look up to the track record that you've put behind you, and I certainly do as well. So really, really appreciate what you do, and thank you for having me on, and let's keep on crushing it, my friend.
Thank you, brother. It means a lot. And thank you, everyone, for listening, for being here. We really appreciate your time and your eardrums.